It's Saturday, September 12th, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio next to the beach in downtown Santa Cruz is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek. Hey, Ben.
Good morning.
And Brian Young, a CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing, Lyle?
Good. Hey, so we're not exactly downtown Santa Cruz, I should say. We're over actually on 7th Avenue is where the station's located in Santa Cruz, but we're very close to the beach. So I want to correct that right away. We actually have other corrections as well, which we'll get back to. But first, let's talk a bit about, data access. In general, the U.S. government's trying to get data access to many companies. I think, Brian, you've got this story.
Oh, yeah. So there are there's a lot of tension these days about how much the government should be able to get access to our data, whether it's communication over cell phones through traditional wiretapping, all the way down to chatting apps and how they encrypt between the two people chatting and whether the government can get access to that. And of course, there's a long history of police needing and wanting access to go after criminals.
And getting that normally with subpoenas. It's the normal pattern, or at least legal pattern to do this.
Well, that's not the only part of the pattern, though. Yes, they normally need a subpoena, but often it's very easy technologically for them to go and get a wiretap. They get the subpoena, and then they just go to the phone company, and for decades, eons, since the beginning practically, there's been these pretty clean arrangements between telecommunications companies and the police.
And the judge.
And the judge.
That signs it.
Yeah, that's all really important. But what's going on nowadays, of course, since the Edward Snowden revelations have come out and the tech companies have realized how much the government has gotten access to the data stream out there, there's been this large movement to encrypt the data transmissions that wasn't encrypted before.
Mm-hmm.
So
one of the ways to encrypt that is a secrecy thing where the two people that are talking to each other have the secret, but nobody in between has it. And therefore, you can't go to some intermediate company and say, hey, give me access to this data channel, because there's just no way for that company potentially to access it.
Right. So we call that end-to-end encryption.
Mm-hmm.
And the security of that is that nobody has the key but the two people talking, and therefore there just is simply, even with the subpoena, no way to break into mm-hmm. that. And that's where all of these...
this is all the backdoor stuff comes from, right?
Exactly. That's where different law officials would love to go ahead and get a second key into that stream that the government has access to. And that gets down to the process of how do you get a warrant and who holds that key and how secure is that key. And when there's two keys, do you really have secure communication? So there's a couple cases that are winding their way through the... not the courts yet, but there is... people are the government is considering whether legal action is something that they want to take. So one of them is with Apple between their FaceTime and messages texting service. Apple has been requested several times to break open the communications for certain cases. And
specifically with iMessage, yes?
Yeah, with iMessage. And not only are they refusing to, but they're simply saying that since iOS 8, they just simply cannot do this. They don't have access to the keys that they would need to break into it. And the government is considering whether they need to take legal action to make sure that they can do this in the future.
Okay, so basically Apple is responding with, we've made iMessage secure enough where we can't actually inject, we can't actually get the data out of it. We can't help you listen to the iMessage conversation.
Right.
And so now the court's deciding whether they want to sue Apple and say, you've got to put this in the future.
Exactly.
Because you have to access it.
Well, what's interesting is I'm not entirely sure that's completely 100% technically true what Apple is saying.
I agree with you. I wanted to dive down to that. I don't think that's true either. I think Apple's wrong about that.
Well, because nobody who uses a iPhone sending a message actually knows what their key is, has control of their key, or anything. So there is a key exchange going on there, and it's being managed by Apple. And
theoretically, they could modify that key exchange to lie to it, and then it would work.
Exactly.
I mean, specifically, the idea is that Brian and Ben know each other, and they both use iMessage. Of course, Apple. I mean, Brian, you don't. I mean, Ben, you don't use iMessage because you don't have an Apple device,
right? I do not.
Okay, so Brian and I are chatting through iMessage.
I have an Android device, right?
No one can talk to you. Yeah, actually, no. That's totally true that in this pattern, you would communicate with us through SMS,
right.
Which isn't encrypted at all.
Right, exactly. So it's probably even worse.
Yeah, oh, it's much worse because the telco can listen to that conversation. Yeah. Or, of course, you and I normally, when we communicate, use Slack, which is probably relatively secure unless the subpoena goes to Slack, mm-hmm. and also Hangouts, which is Google's alternative,
Hangouts, yeah.
which also is comparable to iMessage. So this pattern works for all those things.
Mm.
But specifically, iMessage is doing something that if you, Brian and I are both in the system of Apple and they know that our phone numbers are where they are, and therefore when I say I want to send a message to Brian, Apple gives me Brian's public key, if you will, that Brian holds and then says, this is Brian, and sends the message to Brian. But they could just as easily inject Chandler in the middle there, who's, you know, the government, right? So then they give me a key that says, this is Brian's key, and here, send it to him, and I send it. I use that key and I send it, and Chandler gets it, and then he reads it and gives it to the government, and then he re-encrypts it and sends it to Brian. Like, so the man-in-the-middle attack, Apple could implement if they wanted to.
They could, and it's funny, Tim Cook actually has some quotes about this that I think are pretty illustrative. And he was saying, so if you put a key under the mat for the cops, the burglar can find it too.
Yes.
The whole idea is if the criminals or countries, if they know there's a hidden key somewhere, they won't stop until they find it.
Yeah. All right, let's move on.
Well, there's one more point. That's end-to-end encryption, but there's another thing going on as well, which is where the servers of the data are.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Microsoft case that's going around as well. And the government wants access to stored data, but the servers are not in the U.S.
Ah, yes.
So Microsoft is telling the government that that's fine. They can have access. They need to go to the courts in
the EU.
In the EU, yeah. And get access through their law system. And once that subpoena has been issued, then they're happy to give the data.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the EU has much stronger privacy laws than we currently do when it comes to data like this.
Yeah, interesting.
So it gets down to this question of what laws apply to what data depending on where the server is in the country. And another follow-up on that is people are particularly concerned about Russia and China. In fact, I saw a story where Apple is now going to be storing the Russian data on Russian servers, which if you follow this through, that means that the Russian laws will have authority over the data for everybody in Russia,
mm-hmm.
which may or may not sit well with the people who live in Russia.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, yeah. So where is the safest haven, basically, to get your email stored is a good question. Where are the laws the most generous to privacy?
And it's not clear which laws apply to things yet. There's going to be a lot of inter-country haggling about all this.
A lot of what we're talking about is coming from a story from the New York Times. You can read that Apple and other tech companies tangle with U.S. over data access. All the stuff we talk about, we're actually pulling from multiple sources, and we put it up on our website, geekspeak.org. So if you'd like to know where the original sources are in all those stories, please feel free to read up more. And there, of course, you can also email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, to tell us what we've done wrong and what we could cover again. Let's talk about keys in the physical sense, shall we?
Yes, let's talk about keys in the physical sense. So here I have in my hands the keys to my house and my car. And Lyle, if you took a picture of this with your iPhone,
come on, whip it out.
This is what
it's
the story
a good thing
is about.
This isn't a video show.
This is what the story is about, which is if you take a picture of a key, then you can 3D print that key, assuming that the picture is high enough resolution,
mm-hmm.
which is potentially really bad news.
There's nothing magical about a key. A key is a representation of the number that is the unlocking capability of that lock.
Yeah, and you could
I mean, it's so funny. Of course, a key is a better metaphor for everyone understands that the little up and down spots pins sit in, and if you don't have the exact right shape, the pins don't sit in the right spot, and the key tumbler can't turn.
Right. So that shape is really important. And if you photograph that shape, then, well, you have that shape. It's just in a different form. And so all you have to do is take that shape from the digital world and somehow turns that back into the analog world.
Mm-hmm.
And
has this been done in practice?
Yes, many, many times. Actually, I think, and don't bother searching for it, Lyle, while I'm talking, but I think we've talked about this on GeekSpeak. I did a Google search before the show, and I could not find it anywhere. Because we talk about keys a lot and not very often physical keys.
Well, of course, in the old like Columbo shows, I remember people taking keys and pressing them into clay.
Yeah,
same thing, right?
It's the exact same thing. Exactly.
I've tried that. It's really hard to get it to work.
And I go to my local hardware store and they make keys for me and they don't even work half the time.
Right. Yeah. So there's a paper which I'll also link to, which it says, and I love this quote. Quote, the security, and this is a, by the way, this is a paper from UCSD, University of California, San Diego, Department of Computer Science and Engineering, and they say, the security of any system invariably changes over time as the technological advances challenge the system's implicit assumptions. So when you make a system, you have to make assumptions about what's physically possible, what's not possible, what's hard, what's easy. And the security of that system changes as technology changes and as your assumptions are less valid over time.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular story that I'm covering is about the TSA.
Uh-huh.
So you know those locks that you can buy, the TSA-approved locks?
Wait, why is TSA-approved locks?
Well,
you mean luggage locks?
Yeah, you buy the little luggage locks.
So they don't have to cut it off to search your bag. They can just use their master
exactly.
key.
Exactly. They use their master key.
No. I see how this goes.
And, you know, years ago, I remember saying to somebody, like, doesn't this seem like a bad idea? Like, just one person needs to get that master key. Just the wrong person needs to get that master key. And then they can make a million copies of it if they want to, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
So that apparently didn't happen. But there was an article a little while back. It was called the Secret Life of Baggage, Where Does Your Luggage Go at the Airport? And the Washington Post covered it. And so the TSA...
There were photos in the article.
The TSA and the Washington Post totally messed up. And yes, indeed, there was a photo of the master key. And they took it down very quickly.
Do people, TSA people just have them like hanging on their hip?
I don't know. I did not see this photo because they took it down very quickly after the article was published.
It was on the internet, right?
So it's never down.
Once you put something up, it doesn't come back down.
So to be clear, they do an article about what happens with luggage in the TSA, and in that article that's public to everybody, there's a photograph of one of these keys, just kind of in the photo, not like the centerpiece, just
not at all.
One of the photographs. Someone was like, oh, that's the key.
That
unlocks all
the
locks.
Key, yeah.
And so they... took this thing and made a 3D print.
Someone had that photo, took that, made a CAD rendering of it, 3D printed it, and then had to like. This person was like, I didn't even have a TSA approved lock at home. I had to go find a friend with one, and I tried it, and it worked.
Yeah,
and so he was like, oh my god. So he put the CAD files on GitHub, yeah, so everyone can do this.
Well, so the other thing about this, I mean, this is neat and all that it did from a photograph, but the truth is you can buy these TSA locks. They're not expensive.
Yeah.
You go buy one, you open it up, and you can find out what the pin count is, too. It's not like it's a secret inside the lock, you know? It'd be a little hard to do.
And that's exactly the problem, is that there's people have this feeling that these systems are secure, but they're not secure.
Yes.
And... In a lot of people's from a lot of people's perspective, and I oftentimes share this perspective, it's better for everybody to know that it's not secure than for nobody to know that it's not secure.
So and this comes down to something pretty interesting. Those locks are not about keeping your stuff safe. Those locks are making a subtle social gesture that my stuff is private. I'd like it to be private. And everyone around that luggage that sees the locks is going to engage in that social contract. Because anybody can just rip one of those locks off. They're just connected to zippers. You just rip them off. Like, it's not like the lock is physically that challenging to break.
Right.
Well, here's the funny thing about the internet is we've applied that same social contract to websites and hacking.
That's exactly where I want to go with this. Exactly. The reason why the website stuff of social doesn't make sense anymore is that social contract just has to be broken by someone. who is acting in a non-socially friendly way. Criminal, for example, right?
Which is much easier when you're not face to face, when you're not actually seeing the person doing it.
Also, those actors, those people that do that, are a minority in our society. A minority of the people will break the social contracts. That's why we don't have everybody in prison. Well, let's not get into prison stuff. But anyways, my point is that access of that person, the chance that somebody that has a social ignorance of the social contract of not opening someone's luggage and ripping a lock off, the idea that a person might engage your luggage is relatively rare because your luggage is only going to be seen by 40 people or so, right? Yeah. And so because of that, it's safe to have a social contract around it.
If this was
on the web, though, that one bad actor anywhere on the planet can access it. And therefore, you have to assume that that you have hundreds of people that are bad actors attacking all the time. That's why the backdoor policy for the government is a bad idea, right? And it connects really well. Those two stories are lovely together.
Yeah.
So I want to know one thing. If I don't put a lock on my luggage, am I saying, oh, go ahead and take a look?
I don't know. I don't put a lock on my luggage. Yeah. I think it's kind of silly. But also,
you don't think your underwear is that important?
Exactly. This is Geeks Become Loud Troxel with Brian Young and Ben Jaffe. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Let's get into a longer form discussion now a bit about passwords and cracking and access to data. Because, of course, this whole keys and keeping them secret, very challenging. And the result of not keeping those things secret is somebody breaks into the system and gets all the data. And the big news that we have actually avoided quite a bit on GeekSpeak is that Ashley Madison website. And the reason we kind of didn't cover it a lot on GeekSpeak, unless we covered it when I wasn't on the show. No. Mm-hmm. Is that we keep on thinking, technically it's not that engaging. It's just mostly socially interesting. And it's been covered a lot in the news.
Yeah.
But today we thought we'd talk a little bit about the story from a highly geeky way. So,
as opposed to the smarmy side about people you can't trust taking your passwords.
Yeah.
I guess the introduction to this topic is that Ashley Madison, the website Ashley Madison, is a place where people can find people who are also married and connected.
Married people can.
People can
have affairs
married
with this website.
Have affairs, yeah, mm-hmm. And there's been a whole bunch of information about how there actually were a lot of bots rather than actual female accounts.
Yeah,
and all of this is because a hacking team cracked all of their data, and that's poorly stated, but
got access to their entire database,
got all of the stuff down, and then leaked it. Right.
And first they actually said, pay us or we'll leak it. And then they leaked it.
And then they just leaked it anyway. Yeah. So,
and we're talking about potentially a lot of people.
And this was, unlike most hacking stories, a politically motivated one. They actually were trying to make a change so the site didn't exist. And, of course, it affects people when their private information gets out into the real world.
And that is interesting. We talked about bad actors before, social norms kind of things. These people were acting in that vigilante aspect where they believe the website was, all the people involved in the website and the website itself was bad. They want to take it down. So they believed in their own moral superiority to do an attack on them to make change in their ethical, what they believe was ethically right. So it gets more complicated when you talk about what you believe is correct and what not correct in the bad actor aspect.
The one social, non-geeky thing I just wanted to point out is that people got hurt by this.
Yes, people got hurt a lot.
There were people that were committing suicide over the information getting out.
Mm-hmm. Pretty serious.
Yeah, and it wasn't just like user accounts and that kind of stuff. It was also all the passwords. Now, when we hear something like this, we're like, okay, well, but were they encrypted? Were they hashed? Were they protected? Because if you get if somebody hacks into my computer and I use a password manager called 1Password, and if they get that file, it has all my passwords in it, but they don't have
Password.
Yeah, they don't have my master password, which is the means to open up that vault and get all of my other passwords because of encryption.
So wait a second. Before we get into that, why does it matter that the entire database of Ashley Madison?
Ashley Madison.
All the database and all the users and all their email addresses and usernames are public now because of the way the leak recap. There's passwords in there. Why does it matter what those passwords are?
Because
you're not going to log in again with that that site, right?
Have you ever reused a password on two sites?
Yes, everyone has, of course.
Everyone has. And
that's the problem.
And you and I, and we try to not reuse passwords as much as possible.
Yes.
So I used to reuse passwords before I understood what security was and before I saw that there were a lot of huge downsides, you know? So
it might be that someone was using their really secure password for their bank and for Ashley Madison, because both those things they need to keep very private.
Right. Here's a different example. Recently, Home Depot's systems were compromised and all the credit cards got stolen.
Yeah.
And I got, you know, some
fraudulent
activity on my account, right? Because I bought a piece of plywood within the last couple weeks. Right. And so what happened? The bank account, or my bank canceled my card and sent me a completely new one, because my credit card number is used at all of these different places. So I go to different stores and I use the same credit card number, mm-hmm. right? It's kind of a similar problem with passwords. It's not exactly the same, but it's the same larger concept. If you use the same
secret
private information, if you use the same secret and you entrust it to multiple people, only one of them needs to leak your information, and then anyone can take that secret information and use it on any of your other sites, which is, you know, especially a good reason to have a different password for your bank at the very, very least. But ideally, you want to have different passwords for every single site.
So then it's interesting about this Ashley Madison break-in. I don't actually know how they got the data file, whether it was an error in the coding of the developers mm-hmm. at Ashley Madison, or whether they're just in the cloud and they had access to the hardware.
I saw some articles on that. They expected to take a very long time to do this, and basically the servers were pretty much wide open. They used a very simple
easy to get in.
Yeah, it was one of those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 passwords.
Oh, of the admin account to get it. Okay, so they messed up on even getting access to it. But the secondary question is, did they make the password secure?
Mm. I'm sorry, make which?
Meaning each user's. So.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, should I just, how do you want to cover this? Do you want me to describe how you normally make it safe?
I
tell you what I'm doing on GeekSpeak, for example, for your passwords, if you'd like.
Thank you. No, I'm not going to say my passwords.
No. I'm saying that we can talk about how you actually do this problem of passwords. Because one of the ideas is that my website, the geekspeak.org website,
sure.
When you guys log in, you have a password. Uh-huh. And you enter the password in a text field. And then you submit it, hopefully using the HTTPS, so no one else can
intercept it, yeah.
And then that password, as soon as it gets into the memory of the Ruby on Rails application in the back end,
On
the server, I take that and I add it up to something called a salt. This is a giant random string that's in an entry for you guys. Every time a new account mate's made, I get a big random number and I stick it in there, and that's called a salt. Mm-hmm. I take the salt and I take your password and I add them together, and then I run that through a hashing algorithm, and we'll talk about that in a second, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which basically is a one-way way of taking something and making something again. Okay.
So every time you put it in that algorithm, it comes out the same way.
Yes. That salt plus your right password, the correct password, and that salt always make a number, a big number, that's always the same with that pattern that I use, a mathematical pattern called a hash. I take that and I look in your table for your username, and there's a field in there called hashed password, and I compare the two. And if they're the same, I know that you had the original good password. The thing that's interesting there is I never save your password. I mm-hmm. save this mathematical derived thing of your password.
Right.
Therefore, if someone leaks my database, they don't know your password still.
So they know that, you know, my internal password number that is being compared to is like 1872 blah, 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 blah. But they can't take that and go backwards. You can almost think of it like, so I like to think of algorithms almost like machines, right? So this particular algorithm is a one-way machine. You can only feed things in one side and then they come out the other.
But
you can't take the result and feed it back and get the original
stuff. So you put gasoline into an engine and you get out carbon dioxide and particulates. And a lot of motion. And you can't put that carbon dioxide and motion back into the engine to make gasoline out of it.
Color is a great one for talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
If I give you a color, just a color, and you look at it, you might know it's got some blue and some green in it, it might have some yellow and all that, because you can kind of figure it out, but it's very hard for you to make that exact same color. If instead, therefore, if I know the ingredient to make that color by adding this much blue and this much yellow and this much red, every time I do that, I can make that color over and over and over again, and mm-hmm. you would struggle at it. That's kind of what the hashing thing is like.
Yeah,
you can't separate that back out again. You can't say, how much blue was in it? Like, physically pull that out.
Well, I don't know if the color is a great example. Mathematically, you could figure out exactly what components are in the color. Mm.
Chemically you could, right? You could just put it chemically.
Yeah, but mathematically, you can't take... A hash won't let you go backwards.
Right, there's actually data loss in it. It doesn't have all the data that was originally there. Yeah.
Yeah, so you got the one-way machine. You put your password and this pseudo-random salt thing in... Smush them together, put them through the machine, you get a number. Does that take time?
So that's really interesting. It depends on the algorithm you do.
So you've got different machines. Some are really, really fast and some are slower.
That's right. So the reason why we really like good passwords is if Brian was using Monkey on the GeekSpeak website and my database was lost and everybody got access to it, they could say, well, let's try Monkey. And then they'd take Monkey, the word Monkey, and they'd add it to the salt and they'd do the hash on it and they'd see, is it the same?
And then they're not just trying Monkey, they're trying every English word in the in the language.
Right, and that's called a lookup table, right?
Yeah,
a lookup dictionary. Yeah, and so the trick is that you don't want that salt that I talked about earlier is really important because it made the lookup mean you have to do it individually every single time. Mm-hmm. So if that thing is really, really fast, if you can look up dictionary words in a millisecond, then you can go through all of the English language plus all deviations within a few days. Like, it's not that hard to crack the password. Depending on how good the password was, it's really potentially easy. And so we have an algorithm that's really, really slow. And that the algorithm is called... what is it called?
Bcrypt?
Bcrypt, thank you.
So less than a few days. There are only 180,000 words in the English language.
There you go.
In the dictionary.
And then we actually, you know, replace all the W's with threes because sometimes people do that. Like, there's all these patterns that people kind of do, and we kind of figure those out over time and add more to it when we hack. And I say we. I'm talking about developers, not me. I don't actually do hacking. It's too boring. But, I'm sorry, cracking passwords is too boring.
So,
hacking's fun.
So if it takes a millisecond... Then you can try all of the words in the English in the dictionary
in a minute.
Yeah,
a few minutes,
pretty fast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But if instead you have an algorithm that takes a lot longer, it takes 2 seconds.
And also, it's not
that's going to take forever.
This is the interesting thing about these algorithms is that there's ways to mathematically make these algorithms such that they use a lot of processing power, and there's also ones that use a lot of memory.
Mm.
And the memory one's really interesting because
so it's not just time,
right? Memory hard problems are really interesting because you actually have to have a dedicated resource that has a lot of memory. And most small, and that's normally your bottleneck on mass computing. When you're talking about like distributed computing systems, memory and that kind of thing slows things down. So basically, Bcrypt, I'm not sure if it used memory or processor speed, but you can tell the algorithm when you start it, I want to go through this cycle 12 times or 5 times or 30 times. And the larger you make that number, the slower the whole process is going to be.
So that's almost like making the machine longer or shorter or bigger, require more power or more energy or more, you know,
or
whatever.
Or going through that thing, you know, the color analogy I talked about, I first make a color and then I take that color and I add it to some more stuff and then I take the output of that color and I do it again.
Color.
Of course, we'd all know we just get brown, but the point is that mathematically, you're getting large number sets and so those actually get more complex as you go. So they were using Bcrypt with a 12 on it, which is really, really good.
That sounds really good.
Yeah,
right?
You couldn't crack that. And that's why the people that were hacking in reverse were like, you know, the solution to this is going to take, it's going to take a long time to get these passwords because they did a great job.
A really long time.
Except they didn't. They had a mistake.
They had a mistake.
The other thing they were doing is they were doing a very fast algorithm. First off, this other algorithm, this is great, they were always lowercasing the password and username.
Why?
Just make that lowercase so that's easier.
So I didn't need to remember which capital letters were
in the actual
That's a horrible idea, by the way, because by lowercasing you were basically cutting in half the number of possible characters you can have in a password, which is awful.
Right, which largely decreases your complexity set in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
But the good way of doing it, they did it perfectly. They also just happened to also make something else. And this other thing they made had the lower casing in it. And it was the username and the password added together and hashed with MD5. And MD5 is extremely fast hash that's great for getting... You use MD5 to say, is this file the same as this file? Because it takes so little time to MD5 hash something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really, really fast algorithm. It's easy to do. And therefore... they could very quickly go through the database. How long did it take them to hack the passwords in this thing?
Oh, it was a matter of like a week to hack a large chunk of them. Not all of them, but a large chunk of them.
And the reason the large chunk is that they had this secondary phrase that was saved per user, which was the MD5 hash of that. The only thing is once they got therefore they could go through the entire dictionary really fast and within a few seconds know exactly what the password was, but they didn't know what characters were uppercase or lowercase, so then they just had to go through that one thing and change the case.
So it sounds like...
and then they could get it.
It sounds like they built a fortress.
Yes, they built a fortress.
With a mailbox.
Yes.
And so, like, you know, the fortress, the door's, like, super, super secure. You could, like, detonate a thermonuclear weapon next to it, and it'll just, like, teeter a little, but it won't fall down. Or you could just reach in through the mailbox slot.
Right, the mailbox
open the
with
door.
With the key from the TSA, right? The lock of the TSA.
No.
So, in that mailbox is like, instead of the actual thing you're looking for, it's like a handwritten note of the thing you're looking for, right? Because it's slightly wrong, but it's so close that it's easy to then figure out.
That's so
absolutely
bad.
Right. They built a safe and they put a lockbox on the outside of the safe. Just really silly stuff. The interesting thing, though, is that if you look at the pattern on how they could do this and how they couldn't have done this, there was a flow that did exactly what they wanted. They probably were using this other hash thing as a way of creating temporary keys, something like that, where they were using it for something of the purpose. Not all the accounts have this secondary problem, and most likely they realized at some point that there was a problem with their pattern, so they switched and got away from it. But most of the accounts had this problem.
Yeah.
So security, the reason we bring it up, though, is security is really complicated. Like, obviously, the thing I just described, some of you guys follow along, right? But when we were talking about this earlier, Brian, you asked me what a pepper was.
Yeah.
And I know this stuff pretty well, right? Because I've had to implement it. And I'm like, And I did a Google search.
We're talking about salts.
Yeah, salts,
so what's
and
a,
peppers.
What's a pepper? That's a thing, right?
Yeah, so pepper, the salt is every person has this random thing that stayed in the database with them that's used for this encryption thing to make sure that you've got really unique stuff. The pepper is a server-based one. So it's the same random key thing, but it's the same for everybody on the server. And the reason you might do that is that would be saved in source code, not in the database, and therefore it's slightly more obscure.
Well, yeah. You're just spreading around where your
entropy is.
Everything that needs to be figured out, all the attacks. Assault, no, that can be public. It doesn't matter because it's just protecting you from one kind of attack.
Well, no, assault can't be public. Well, yes,
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah. Assault just makes it so that you're randomizing it extra so you can't have one table that's figured out all of the possible.
Do you know what that table is called?
A rainbow table?
It's called a rainbow table. That's right. There's actually a great book by Cory Doctorow called The Knights of the Rainbow Table about some hackers that make a giant distributed rainbow table of all known password possibilities with all hashes. And then what you do is you don't actually go through all those slow algorithms. You just look in the table to see if the pattern's there, and then you get a result.
You pre-compute everything.
What
I love about this is we start out with simple passwords years and years ago. And then hackers figured out a way to attack it. And then we come up with all these systems to get around to harden the system so that hackers can't do one particular attack. And now we end up with this incredibly complex system that it's so hard to implement right that that you just get lost. And on top of that, the weakest link is still you and me.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Humans, yeah. So if this entire segment was like blah 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 blah, blah
welcome to Geek Speak
to you, like right, yeah, welcome to Geek Speak. But also, the point of this, the point of bringing it up here on this show in particular, is not just to talk about how it's technically implemented and all that, but to say if you're using passwords, if you're reusing your passwords, don't, you know, like seriously consider going out and you know, using a password manager so you can have unique passwords on every single one of your sites, because it's not about that it happened to the Ashley Madison site. That's not the point. The point is it can happen to any website. It can happen to any website where you have a user account that maybe you don't even use, but you're using the same password there as you are somewhere else. And that's really the problem.
And a password manager is a, you know, software that can run on your phone and your desktop and all that. But the problems with those things is that if you do lose that database or have problems with it, you've got a serious problem. So it works great for geeks because we all go, okay, well, I got a copy there and I got a copy there and I've got encrypted this and I'll do that. Like, we manage it like we do backups, right? We're relatively good at that. For the average user, using one of these things is tricky because you have to.
I think there are good ways to do it. And a lot of them will, these password managers will oftentimes guide you through good ways of doing it. Like LastPass is in the cloud. So you're not going to lose your database as long as you don't forget your password. And you're already dealing with not forgetting your password because you've got, you know, at least one password on a bunch of different sites. So you just have to have a nice secure one that you remember.
The idea is one password to keep track of instead of thousands.
Right, exactly.
Where's your password encrypted file? Is it in Dropbox?
And I use 1Password, and that's on your actual physical computer, not up in the cloud.
Right.
And I'm syncing it between my computers with Dropbox.
Oh, so everybody, that's easy, right?
They made it super easy to set that up too, right?
So absolutely.
If my computer crashes or something, I haven't lost the database with all my passwords.
So you do need to know your master password and also your Dropbox password.
Yeah.
So two passwords. Now, so there's another one if you really want to go lower tech on all this. Mm-hmm. And for years we said don't write down your passwords because what would happen is next to your computer where you used it, like in your office, you'd write down your password and anyone that came in could find your password and use it. And
so we said board games.
So we say don't write your password down. Don't write down your password. Don't write down your password. The truth is because we shouldn't be reusing our passwords, it's actually better to write them down than to reuse them.
Yeah, because of the hackers that are going to attack you during your life, very few of them will come into your office.
That's right. So I actually recommend a strategy if you don't want to get into a software pattern where you're not really sure if you're going to, like, if you're going to be offline for 3 months and then come back and is your password system still there. Instead, get a little book, little pretty little book, and write the things down in the book. And just do one thing for yourself. Transpose. Have some little pattern that you know, and only you know, where actually in the front of all these passwords is a 7, or the third character is actually in the front. Very simple trick that's true on all your passwords. Don't tell anyone that trick. Even if they pick up your book, they can't use it.
Because they don't know your little secret, which is...
Would have to take your book and then put it into his machine and then crack that. And that's not going to happen. So it's safer.
Yeah, much safer.
Hey, we'll get back to more geek stories in just a minute. I'm Lyle Trox with Brian Young and Ben Jaffe. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Ben Jaffe and Brian Young from beautiful downtown Santa Cruz, where the fog is still down. It's nice. Go for a walk afterwards at the beach. Hey, earlier today, because we were live in the studio, we were listening to Dawn, and she's the show right before us, Dr. Dawn, and she covered the story that one of our listeners, Rich Rollins, sent in, all about 3D printing a sternum and rib cages to a patient who had cancer in the sternum. They had removed a large chunk of the bones, they put in a 3D printed rib cage replacement, if you want to hear all of that, and lots of more medical advice. It's on Dr. Dawn's show, and one of you got to look up the website. I think it's Optimedia. Well, we'll look it up, and we'll give that in a few minutes. Let's go ahead and talk about Wikipedia.
OptimageHealth.com.
OptimageHealth.com. Thank you. And actually, if you go to geekspeak.org, one of the links on the right-hand side is Dr. Dawn.
Then you don't have to worry about spelling it.
That's right, geekspeak.org.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, it's OptiImage. That's how I would read it.
No, it's Optimage.
Oh, OptimageHealth.
You can also do a search on Dr. Dawn on iTunes.
I just searched for Dr. Dawn.
Dr. Dawn.
Yeah. It's like searching for Facebook and then clicking on Facebook.
And every time I mention our show, and I got to mention this, especially for podcast listeners that only just listen to us from the cloud, Dawn comes in the studio and she has books around her and a few news clips. We come in, all of us have a laptop with the entire power of the internet behind it. She does the show by herself, asking people ask questions, and she just randomly knows like exactly the answer.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's amazing.
It's amazing to see it live compared to us. Like, we're kind of a disappointment. No, Lyle just looked that up. It's that story. He doesn't know every episode of Geek Speak. Oh, he just looked it up. Oh, man. Anyway, let's go on to Wikipedia, which is one of our great sources for having knowledge on this show.
Right.
So I feel like we need a little refresher here. Everybody knows Wikipedia is the online encyclopedia that everybody can contribute to. Can you still do it anonymously? You have to have a login.
You can do it anonymously, I believe, but it's you're more suspect.
More suspect.
It's less likely that your thing will get accepted.
So they have rules. They have rules on what kind of articles can be made. You can't just put one up there about your cat. Mm-hmm. They're going to take that down because that doesn't qualify as something news and noteworthy that they want to have in their encyclopedia.
What about my dog?
A Higgs boson? The Higgs boson is in...
That's right. That's what you do. If you want your dog on Wikipedia, make sure to name it after something that's on Wikipedia. It's perfect. So go on.
So there was a scam that revolves around Wikipedia that's based on this idea that not everything is allowed to be up there. And they're preying on people that are either new to Wikipedia or just are a little on the gullible side. But what they were doing is they were watching for the articles that were getting taken down, the ones that just didn't qualify and the editors were saying that that this shouldn't be there and they were going away. So they would contact the person who had their article taken down and they would say, we will guarantee that that article can stay up. We will protect it and make sure it can stay up if you pay us $30.
Okay. So was it true that if you paid these people $30, they'd make sure the article stayed up on Wikipedia?
I'm sure they can do brute force for a little while, but they can't guarantee that.
Oh, interesting.
Because all they're doing is they're fighting with the editors on when the editor takes it down, then they're going to put it back
up. So this is
up.
Bad because lots of times people that are motivated that don't know the rules process and all that are people that are like, well, my grandfather just died. He had this amazing life. He's important to me and important to all the people he's touched. I'm going to make a Wikipedia article about him, put all this information, all this great data up, and then someone comes along and says, I'm sorry, there's barely a news mention of him, therefore he's not noteworthy enough to be on an encyclopedia, and that's the kind of rules. It's challenging.
Exactly.
And takes it down. So that person's in a vulnerable spot. They've already invested time and energy in it, and someone says, hey, you pay us some money, we'll put it up. I can see how they'd make some money.
Or it's small business owners, or mm-hmm. it's actors that want their name out there.
Sure.
Or the photographers or artists, craftsmen that believe that they should be on Wikipedia because they think they are the most important artist in the world. Mm-hmm. Well, they are to them. But when somebody comes in and says, well, I'm sorry, your article is taken down, but if you pay me $30, I'm going to keep that thing up there for you. Hmm. That can be compelling to
absolutely.
A few people.
But, so how much money was being gained this way from innocent people?
So Wikipedia, like we said, they have strong rules. They actually have not released the information to investigate financially how much money was taken. What the actions they've done is they've contacted the victims of this scheme, and they've taken the 331 suspected Black Hat accounts offline.
Okay.
And I believe that they said that there will be a police investigation that will have access to the...
They discovered this, right? The Wikipedia, someone at the company or some volunteers.
So they have some users that are called, I love this word, functionaries. These are highly trusted, I believe still volunteers. Most of the organization is volunteers that have access to the back-end database. They have access to a tool called Check User. And they're the only ones in the organization that can look up where a user logged in from, what the IP address of that user was, what pages and sections were edited by that user. And they look for patterns that are suspect.
Right.
And it took months to investigate this and find this out. And they have deleted all the 110 articles that were up there from the users that were thinking they were getting protected.
Oh, that's
so
too bad.
It doesn't sound like it was a really broad scheme.
It also sounds like what they'll do is they'll add messaging so that when a page is denied, you say, hey, this is denied because of these rules. If someone offers you money, it doesn't mean it's going to go back up. You know, kind of warn people when it gets denied because, of course, there is a communication pattern that can jump in there. So this hopefully will get mitigated from that perspective.
Education is going to help.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, it's an anonymous public resource. It's really hard to protect from everything.
So let's move on. Thank you, Brian. So we talked a while ago about kind of the data flow problems of having auto updates and specifically around Windows 10 and how there's this concern that it was going to break the internet. We covered this on an earlier show of GeekSpeak. Is there any more update status on that?
Wait, have we covered the story about Windows 10 being downloaded to computers, whether or not users have asked for it?
This is a new one. Wait, what do you mean whether or not people have asked for it?
Right. okay, so basically if you have a Windows 7 or Windows 8 machine, it is possible, likely, maybe everyone gets this, I'm not sure, that you will get Windows 10 downloaded to your computer so that way Microsoft can install it in case you want it.
Oh, cool. So basically you're saying that even if you don't choose to upgrade...
Even if you don't
if you don't have auto upgrade on or anything.
No, you do have to have auto update for patches.
Which we recommend.
Which everyone should
have auto update for patches, but not for upgrades.
That's the problem, is that this is not... I opted into upgrades path. This is I opted into security patches and things path. But, I mean, okay, so a couple things. First
is
of
Windows
all,
10 big?
Yeah.
Okay, because it could be a problem for your hard drive.
Yeah, it's very big. It's between 3.5 to 6 gigabytes.
Yeah, that's pretty big.
Downloaded over I hope it's not a metered internet connection.
Oh, and some people do have metered internet connections.
Right?
Well,
ouch.
My mom won't even download the ballet of my daughter because it's so big it takes forever. If she had this, she'd be stuck from days.
Right,
well, the thing is, it's happening in the background, right?
So right. But you don't know why your internet connection is so slow.
So this is a story based on some information that this is on the Enquirer.net. So an Enquirer reader pointed out to the Enquirer, he said... a couple things. First of all, the symptoms are repeated failed update to Windows 10 in the Windows update history and a huge file labeled $WBT. And he also said that his own slow DSL was crawling for a week until he discovered this problem.
Sure.
That's no good. So
that's a bummer.
They reached out to Microsoft and were like, what's up? And Microsoft's like, oh, yeah, we're doing this.
Well, the good side of this is if you finally decide to upgrade your system, it's going to happen a lot faster.
It's going to happen immediately, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But like, this is not a security. This is not an update to your operating system. This is the new operating system. So, yeah. Like, if I was on a metered data connection, for example, and I decided I wanted to upgrade to Windows 10 from Windows 8 or Windows 7.
That's your choice.
I would go find a university library and update from there, because 6 gigabytes is nothing to sneeze at, as
yeah.
they say.
Well, so the other pattern about this is that if you want to be more secure, in my mind, for operating systems, you want to wait a few weeks at least.
Oh, yeah, there's
for
that too.
That first patch that hits is important. Oh, Windows yeah. Windows XP, for example, Service Pack 2 was kind of necessary to then let mm-hmm. the operating system. You know, like, so in some sense, you might want to decide on those larger mm-hmm. Things. Security updates you should do right away.
It's like, oh, we just built this rocket. Hey, everybody, climb in. It's our first test flight.
At the same time, I would say bummer about this, because I really want Microsoft to win on this. It's time mm-hmm. we got Microsoft OS back up to par. And I've made transitions multiple times in my life on operating systems. Yeah. I want to go onto Windows again sometime soon.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So I want Windows 10 to be awesome.
You want there to be a competition, right?
Absolutely. It's essential.
I say bummer primarily because this is going to be a disincentive for people to update. People are going to be like, oh, yeah, that thing happened. Windows update runs, my internet gets really slow for sometimes days at a time. And, you know, like, what if you have a 32-gigabyte flash drive and, you know, 5 gigabytes of it is your Windows 10 update that you're not planning to install anytime soon?
It's okay. Microsoft is solving that problem because they're backporting certain things to previous versions of Windows. Like, there was this thing that they were adding to so that your information... I'm going to mess this up.
Well, let me just say one other thing about Windows 10. Windows 10 is theoretically more like an auto-updating operating system that might not actually have a Windows 11, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it might be that they're going to be on Windows 10 for a long time with small updates. Yeah. So potentially this isn't as big a deal as once you get in there. Keep in mind, all the engineers that work on this, all these people, are really into everybody getting to Windows 10 because all of these problems get solved. So, yeah. I see the motivation.
Yeah, I totally see the motivation, too. It's just... I think the wrong way to go about it. I think auto updates are important, as we've seen with browsers, and as we see that, you know, 10% of Windows machines are still on XP or Vista. So auto updates are important, but...
So the good news and the thing I'm kind of happy to say is that I think Windows 10 is actually a pretty good operating system.
That's good.
Played with it. People I trust and use it primarily are happy with it. Chandler, our intern, is here. Are you running Windows 10 yet? He's running Windows 10. He likes it. Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Thumbs up.
All right. So Chandler's approved college computer science geek says, yes, Windows 10. Good. So the point being is that it is probably time to update. Go ahead and go to Windows 10, mm-hmm. assuming your hardware can handle it. Let's do another little follow-up, if we could. Adblock.
Ad blocking. So I suspected something would happen, and I just wanted to pass it on that it is. We've talked about ad blocking several times over the last couple months, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on the ad networks to find another way. Mm-hmm. So the way ad blocking works is that, Lyle, you are...
Geekspeak.org.
Geekspeak.org. And Ben, you are the ad service, and I am the web browser. And I say, I want the page from you, Lyle.
Here is the page for you from Geekspeak.org.
And on that page, there's an ad. So my browser goes, ad server, what
Yo,
is...
Yo, what's up? Here's the ad.
Oh, cool. And now I show you both. But ad blockers notice that the ad's being served from somewhere else.
Yeah, all the ads are coming from Ben.
What some ad services are starting to do is to say, hey, server, would you hold this little program here?
You mean like a reverse proxy?
A reverse proxy. Uh-huh. And I go, hey, sir, Geekspeak, give me a page.
Here's my page.
And I say, okay, give me this asset on the page. It's a whatchamacallit.
Oh, this is an asset that I don't actually have. Hey, Ben, give me that asset.
Oh, here. Okay, Lyle, here's the
here
ad.
Here you go, Brian.
Oh, now I got it all. But wait, my ad blocker didn't realize there's an ad that slipped in there.
That's right, because I act as the middleman. It looks like it's coming from me, just like all the other services.
So this is much more complex for the ad servers to set up and for websites to use, but it is starting to happen.
Yeah, and the thing that's kind of nice about this from a web server perspective is that because I'm serving that kind of stuff, theoretically, I have more control over the payload distribution. In current patterns, if you want to use ads on your website, you kind of have to trust the ad network's performance and their implementations, and therefore you have some vulnerability there. So I do like that pattern better. It also means that theoretically I could lie to Ben about how many ads I'm serving. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of a tricky thing there too. Anyway, any other really quick stories?
Yes, superheated solar tornado on the surface of the sun.
Oh, a big storm on the sun?
Huge storm on the sun. So first of all, when I first saw this image, I was like, that's a really big tornado on Earth. I wonder where that is. Oh, that's the sun. That's really big. And second of all, I saw a comet. Someone was like, whoa, it's amazing how fast everything must be moving. It's like crazy velocities. And then someone's like, dude, that's a 10-day time lapse.
Cool. You can see that web extra up at geekspeak.org. See the giant storm on the sun. Geekspeak is registered service mark by David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like it, as long as you tell them where you got it. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 and KUSP.org, live online. And, of course, you can get all the information about our show at geekspeak.org. If you want to send us questions or comments, you can do through email, geeks@geekspeak.org, Twitter and Facebook, we're KUSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell with Brian Young and Ben Jaffe. And this is the September 12th episode of Geek Speak.